Welcome to the Share Life podcast with Jason Scott Montoya, where we explore stories and systems to live better and work smarter.
Welcome to an inspirational people interview on the Share Life podcast. Today I am speaking with longtime creator, illustrator, designer, and animator, sometimes also writer, Tom Biondalillo. Tom, say hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Glad, yes, thank you for sharing your life with us today. Tom and I go way back. I moved to Atlanta in 2005. When I moved here, I transferred from the university I was in Arizona to the Art Institute of Atlanta, and Tom was one of my professors, and one of my favorite professors. We had many great conversations, and we also ended up going on a trip together through a project that I was involved with called SaveTheSoldiers.com. We went to Paris Island, which is where the Marine Corps does their training. They have a thing called the Crucible, where they put their new recruits through the Crucible. So we went on a media trip to Paris Island, which was a wonderful experience for both of us and inspired some shifts in Tom's thinking, which he'll share. But that's a little bit about how we got connected. We stayed in touch a little bit here and there over the years, but kind of lost touch. But I wanted to reconnect with him, get him on the podcast, have him share his story, which is a very inspiring and exciting one. So, Tom, I'll let you take it from here. How did you tell us your story? How you ended up as a designer and illustrator? How you ended up teaching on the side, and how that evolved?
So, if you're talking, and I'm going to jump around here just because.
Yeah, go ahead.
Where I am, I'm older, and my trip out my ear sometimes. So I remember as a second grade, Our Lady of the Sacred Heart Cathedral School in Rochester, New York. I remember somebody showed me a Fantastic Four comic book. I remember the scenes and the panels, and it was, as far as I remember, the way I reacted, it was like magic. I don't know if I had ever seen or really paid attention to the blocks and all of the different pictures. So just the idea of just sequential art and comic books was fantastic and alien to me. And I remember just staring, and I can even see the pictures of the Thing, and Galacticus was in it too, and a fight that they were having. And later on, I even hunted down that comic book. But I looked at it, and I just was thinking, I want to do this. I want to do this. This is fantastic.
Yeah. And it's interesting. Silver Surfer was one of my favorite comics as a kid.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the heralds of Galactus. Yes. Do you think that they handled him well in the movies?
No, I feel like we haven't really gotten a Silver Surfer worthy of the screen.
Absolutely. This story is so, it's one of the best stories out there. The Bells of Shalabal, and it's inspired Stevie Ray Vaughan's album by the same name. So I went through school. I didn't do much art, didn't have much art until about high school. And then I had a pretty good, albeit kind of listless art teacher, but he was happy to have a student who actually cared and did things. So while he kind of did the daycare of what the art room was, and I think it was junior year, maybe I did a little bit in sophomore and the freshman year. But I really remember getting into it with this one guy. And he provided things, he encouraged, he talked to me, got me in some competitions and everything. And I started really getting on it rather than just drawing on my own, getting into learning art rather than just every once in a while doodling away, which I used to do all the time, just as like going to my own little world and on pieces of paper. In fact, I was constantly, as a little kid, I was constantly yelled at by my parents because how some books, especially the really good expensive ones, the hardbacks, have a couple of pages of just white paper before they get to the titles, and I would rip those out in the front and back. My old parents' library, they were kind of happy, but at the same time, they didn't like this ripping out these pieces of paper. They should have just bought me a pad. Anyway, so I got in high school and really realized, all right, there's things to learn and things to do. And So I started pursuing it a little bit more, but still just for fun for myself. And I went to college. Was always that guy who drew in the cafeteria, did this and that. It was an attention getting thing too. Mm. So I went to college and I wanted to do something in art. I really was one of those kids who went to college because you go to college, right?
Yeah.
So I got in and I just chose art, but then art history. I listened to somebody who immediately said, you can't make a living in art. You know, you're going to end up a bum, et cetera, et cetera. So I was like, all right, well, maybe art history is a more lucrative or better path. Now, anybody listening to that should have laughed. It's almost as bad as saying I wanted a philosophy degree, which I like philosophy, which I was talked out of a second degree in philosophy by the philosophy chair.
You wanted a double whammy.
Read books. I'm gonna help you out, kid. Just read books if you like it. Do not get a philosophy degree. But I went into art history and learned more and more about it. And I love it. And, you know, I've done some art history courses and teach them and created them. But there I kept on going, doing t-shirts and learning some more technical things and getting out in the business too. But after I got done with my art history degree, I realized I probably want to do the art, not just learn about the art.
Yeah.
So I went back immediately. In fact, I never even left that school. It was just easier to stay there. And I got another degree in painting and drawing. That was rough in and of itself because it was the 80s and it was just a time when they just, you know, pee in a jar and call it art. They put a basketball in a bowl of gelatin.
The postmodern art era.
If you mean meaningless. I mean, you could talk it up and I'm good at that too. But I was stuck there. Wonderful professors, but I wanted to learn about the technicality of the tools, the brushes, the airbrush, the mixing of things. It was like pulling teeth to actually learn something specifically about making art, where any kid comes in there and rips a baby head off and puts it in a box, spray paints it black. They thought was the next coming of Jasper Johns So I wanted to do illustration. I wanted to do book covers. I wanted to do specific things. And what I felt at that time was not actually doing something with art.
Yeah.
So I had to play this game of making everything kind of more conceptual and talking, I would say nonsense about it, but talking endlessly to kind of satiate my professors who that was more of their frequency. While at the same time actually trying to legitimately develop some technique and some pieces that could be a portfolio. So a lot of my stuff ended up being representational, but also in more of the surreal end of the pond.
Okay.
And doing those sort of things. And, you know, I put a lot of time at that point into some of my own work, my own illustrations. I went out and got other jobs. During the summer, I realized that they didn't have shows for some of the smaller galleries that were in the art building. So me and a couple other guys who really cared about what we were doing would put together these art shows and we just make bodies of work and put them up there. And God, it was ugly, but it was great.
Were you able to sell anything?
Yeah, no, I sold things. I sold things, there. Then I started sending out some of my work. Still, it was a little surrealistic, but it showed the ability to do a theme or a specific prompt. And I started getting some jobs. Sent out, of course, to comic books. That's a whole other thing. There's a whole world of having to know what you're doing when it comes to comic books. But as far as for just sheer illustration, just spot illustrations and so on, my first big job was, other than local, was I worked for D&D and TSR, the old Dungeons and Dragons stuff, back when it was really, you know, popular. Dungeons and Dragons.
Was that in the 90s or still the 80s?
That would be the early 90s.
Okay.
Oh, well.
So if someone played Dungeons and Dragons during that era, what are some of the types of things they would have seen that might have been your work?
Oh, okay. So like Dragon's Lair, not Dungeons & Dragons, Dragonlance series.
Okay.
I would do some interiors. And I worked with some really great cover artists, Larry Elmore. Actually met him later on. I knew of him. Mike Kaluta did some stuff for some of the covers where I do interior work. Sometimes it was mixed with many different artists. Sometimes I would do the entire book, which is cool. I like that because it was just me. It's just all my own. And I do black and white. Sometimes I would do some color stuff. I worked on some of the Star Wars stuff when they weren't so easy to license it. Like now it's on a toothbrush, you know, it's everywhere. Yeah.
It's back then they were very protective of it.
Yeah. So I had, you had to get approved by LucasArts or, you know, and that was kind of cool. So I did, they would license it out to either Pinnacle, someplace called Pinnacle Entertainment or West something. Gosh, so many names. Games, West End Games. And it was really interesting and fun stuff. I got to work not only in the Star Wars universe, but do a lot of interesting work for worlds and histories that really we haven't seen until the most recent movies come up. So the saber rakes and different sorts of courtiers of the old empire.
Yeah,
really interesting stuff. Way back in the early 90s. So it was good to work on those, on even those licenses and so on.
So the gallery work led to the commercial work, and was was it financially viable, or were you like a serving artist?
I was always working. I was working at a gym, or actually for my first couple of degrees, I bounced at bars. I was about 30, 40 pounds heavier. Absolutely. Yeah. So I bounced to the bars, and that was another side of me too. I worked either in Rochester and in some of the cities and this punk bar called Idols. And a lot of the townie bars where my college was. Mm. So
did you switch from bouncing to teaching on the side? Is that how that happened?
Well, okay, so I finished up my second degree. I realized, all right, art history, art, I guess I had to teach academia. I thought that at least it was something that I would do while I would do my own work and build a name and move forward with my art and my creation and my ideas. We were talking earlier about ideas. All my art is fueled by ideas and narratives of saying something, even if it's just one picture. I like to think of a sort of narrative illustration. I always tried to draw a scene, what compose it thematically and even visually, that it says what happened before, it then encapsulates and freezes what's going on now, and then but also implies about what's going to happen, which fits into how you do like three panels in a comic book or so. I ended up to do that. I then wanted to now actually get a degree that was very specific. So I was going to go down to Savannah College of Art and Design, and there was a couple of the schools that I could have gone to, but I also wanted to. I was just married,
And where were you living before that? What part of the country?
By Rochester, New York, SUNY Brockport, which is a little college town by the Erie Canal beside Rochester, but between Rochester and Buffalo, that area. And also through a different job, I was working at a place called Heritage Christian Homes too. Mm. And so I was helping out with different houses and vocations for development disabled. So it's a great place to meet a wife. I mean, nice, safe, good values, or at least a good start, more checks in the plus column when I went looking for her.
How old were you when you married?
I was 22 or 23.
Okay. Yeah.
So, It's all running together at this point.
the blur.
But Savannah College of Art and Design was far away, and I didn't particularly like, I love upstate New York during the summer, but I didn't like what my parents went through trying to be business people, taxes, political issues, any number of different things. And it was, you know, it was upstate New York, but still, and that with the snow. I mean, the constant tundra for months and months.
Shoveling.
Yeah. So I had a new life with a wife, and I was going to go out there and finish myself up and, you know, more college, you know. So I got a fellowship down at Savannah College of Art and Design and went down there. Instead of getting into illustration, I figured I'd go into a new subject, which was at that point the first sequential art master's or program period that was developed. And I figured I'd kind of bridge that with animation and movie storyboarding and concept and illustration techniques and also writing and illustration stories, which always drive my heart. So I went down there and did that. And I was at that point too, I had continued to send out work to different companies. And in those days you had to go into like a bookstore and look at the books. You'd have to look at, you know, a TSR, gaming expansion or a magazine. And I literally would open it up and write down any names, any phone numbers, any addresses, and just blindly send out to these people or call them up and see how they wanted it. There wasn't, obviously it wasn't online. Yeah. I mean, there was, but it's just was very.
Yeah. I remember doing that once with a comic book, and they, for like months and months later, I ended up getting this box of a bunch of comics just as a result of they just finally
responded.
It's wonderful
that they did anything for it. Yeah. And I got lots of, I wish I'd kept all my rejection letters.
Okay. Yeah.
So there actually were some famous editors that, you know, I'm very proud that they rejected me.
Yeah.
It would have been nice to have one from Archie Goodwin from DC or something.
Okay. Yeah.
So like I said, I was going to jump around here. So before I went down there, I was already, you know, through my other degrees and forcing myself into more illustrative stuff, I was starting to get some jobs. And also I'd hooked up with some creative and gaming and other sorts of, even little movie concepts from independent movie makers up there. So I'd been doing some stuff that was business, entrepreneurial, freelance, and goal-based. So I had a decent portfolio, which is how I won my fellowship there. And I also was already working nationally and internationally for different companies that I actually just went after, which is really a good going through some sort of tough process that there's a threshold. There's something you have to do to get in. I don't think that happens enough now. It's just either too easy or it's just handed over really.
Well, you have a strong, as long as I've known you, you've had a strong work ethic, sense of responsibility. Is that something that's kind of part of your personality, or did you learn that growing up, or did your parents instill it, or is it a combination of factors?
My parents were, my father, he worked for a company called Kodak, and he worked on some of, like, especially in the Vietnam War, he worked on some of the government programs with NASA and so on, dealing with the cameras. Kodak was a camera. And a film company. So he did a lot of work with my father-in-law. They worked on the same thing. They were in the same company. And they worked on like the moon landing cameras, either testing them or I think he also was involved with chemical coatings of lenses. So that's how he did his service to the nation during the Vietnam War. He always pointed that out. I don't know whether maybe he felt like a lot of his friends went over there and he had to always mention that. Like, that was my Vietnam service, you know, that's why I wasn't in the draft. But during that, he then loved being creative and working with his hands. And my mother was an artist too. She was a vocal and a pianist, but also had a background in painting and art. So I was involved in all of that sort of stuff. And then he took his furniture making and crafting that he wanted to and did his own business. And he did that while he was working hard as a full-time. I mean, he did the night shift too for extra money because he had five kids just like you. Good Catholic family.
Yeah.
and my mother and so both creative and artistic and also hardworking, and he had a business on the side, and eventually he left working at Kodak and went into the business completely. So I was always there for money issues, government issues, EPA issues, because he was involved in painting and stripping of period pieces, antique furniture and so on. He was that sort of a craftsman and furniture maker.
Yeah.
So I heard about a lot of different issues dealing with running a business and dealing with all the people and so on. So I guess that's where I gathered it from.
Yeah. Okay.
Although it's always been scary for me to start a business, especially. I've never had the experience beyond having partnerships or having some farmed out work for minor jobs of having an employee.
Yeah.
I've never jumped in that, you know.
Yeah. Well, I jumped out of it. So, pros and cons to both. Yeah. when I work with companies that have staff or marketing agencies that have staff, I'm reminded of why I did that. Not because the staff is a problem, but it's just you got payroll and an office, and although the pandemic kind of shifted that a little bit. But
you end up being a slave.
I think it really comes down to what does he want. And what I wanted, having a company just didn't really give that to me. And I've come to realize that freelancing is actually the better path for giving me what I want or what I value. So,
yeah. So, I went down to Savannah, and Savannah is a wonderful place. Anybody who's ever gone there is fantastic. The college kind of sprawls over the whole downtown, and it's just gorgeous. I finished up there, continued to work. I even taught a couple classes there after I was done with my master's and continued to build my freelance. At that point, I'd started to make a few forays into comic books, and still probably did more illustration, single cover, etc. illustration, or even if it was a series illustrations for books and so on. But it's kind of all over the place, very eclectic. Yeah.
Did the illustration stuff, was it in the 90s when it started to shift to the computer?
Okay, yeah. So in 1992, 93, when I got down there, I was happy to finally get some computer classes. Yeah. So I learned Photoshop and all the Adobe stuff, and learned from a good guy, Darren something, I forget his last name. He taught some basics about using layers and all these different things I'd been doing by hand.
Yeah.
You know, you could do digital masks instead of actually putting masking tape down. And you could actually, you have this wonderful thing called Command Z, which is undo. my undo is a lot of swearing and ripping it apart at 3 o'clock in the morning and starting it over. That's my undo. So computers are fantastic. And right around the early 90s. Now, computers were still, if you wanted to buy them, Macs were the only thing, back then for arts. At least they good marketing to push that.
Yeah.
But they were they're multiple $1,000s. So it was a big deal. Like I think my first one was $5,000, and I didn't buy that for a few more years later.
Yeah.
So it was right around then, and it was fantastic. And I still go back and forth. I still like to have traditional. Like I'll start out with my traditional base. With my inks, I'll bring them into Photoshop and do some colors. Sometimes I'll even do things in Photoshop, bring them out, ink it. Okay. I might do blue lines and then print them out on some good paper, good printer that can hold that weight of paper. And then I'd ink over it. Then I'd scan them back in for colors. Even though I did a lot of my freelance work was painting, and I liked painting by hand. Once I got going on digital painting and Photoshop or in different programs, I liked staying there. It's you know. But I always wanted some piece, one to sell at conventions, or just that intrinsic of a real thing that I could sell or keep. I just liked doing that hand drawing and drafting out.
Yeah.
I'll still just do a piece like that. And more with AI becoming such a, I don't know what the term is, but AI being so.
Well, it's all, it's all derivative. It's all derivative.
It's garbage. It's absolutely garbage. I'm lucky for the tastes of America, garbage. So it's fitting in quite nicely. I'm teaching all digital design. I mean, I let my students do hand done stuff, and then I would do.
Well, what's your okay? So what's your case to the students who are seeing this AI generated art? What's your case to, like, why they should still care about being a good artist? Because that seems like the debate that they might.
I don't know what case you make to anybody these days. The people who have drawn, and there are, I am more than ever, maybe I'm just noticing or whatever, there are a lot of people who have some really good skills from their hand and their mind to draw, whether it's digitally or whatever. So they're good draftsmen, they put a lot of time in, so they've got some really, really good skills. So that's a good basis, so they're not just going to use a computer as a crutch. So, it's specifically to your question, how do I make my case? We barely talked about it. They don't want to hear about it. Now, I don't mean that in, like, they're ignorant or whatever, but they still just, I don't think they realize it, and they're coming to me to learn how to do art design and everything. I don't teach Photoshop 101. I'll teach design, but we'll use Photoshop and AI and, you know, any other program like that. And my teaching is always about something that is going to go to your mind. It's going to be decisions. Something that they can be discerning about. That doesn't matter what physical tool or what, you know, fancy program they have on a complicated, you know, flashlight, like a computer. You know, something that it can transfer from acrylic painting to Photoshop back out, or when a new program comes along, you know?
Yeah.
So I teach them so they know the bigger pictures. While at the same time, they need some instrumental training on a program. And of course, that's going to be the mainstream, the high percentage programs. It's still Adobe, but there are specific ones there too, to learn. But that's what they want. They want that as a base. I haven't. It might be. I don't know. I'm just starting to react to it too. I guess I've had my head in the sand too, and they still have their head in the sand. And but right now, they just want to, in a box, understand that. But more and more, my comments revolve around being able to do stuff with real people, with real people's hands, with real things. And there's going to be, I think there's going to be a renaissance.
I actually agree with you. And I think we're looking at an artistic renaissance across mediums.
It's schlock.
And it's happening.
It's schlock. You know, it probably won't matter once they get their hands on our nuclear arsenal. You know?
So how do you reconcile, or how do you go from being the artist to teaching art? And all doing both at the same time, obviously. So,
you know, it's just talking about what I do. It's helped a lot that I do. And I've always kind of delineated myself. You know, I teach what I've done. I teach what I do. So that's given me a good advantage. It's kind of grounded me. You met me probably when I was a little too academic, full of myself. You know?
Well, I started the Art Institute in 2005 and graduated in 2008, so I guess that's the window.
yeah, right up there. 2005 to 2008, maybe I just got sick of hearing myself talk. So I started being a little more precise and a little more straight to the point. And as a teacher, you've got to be redundant too. So
I'm
go on.
I was going to say, is there something about what you love about art is the novelty versus the redundancy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I loved as a freelancer, too. I wanted to, it's a constant puzzle about how to design something, how to express something. Depending on the piece of work, it can be a jumble of whatever the theme is, but it's always with me. I love just basic, that underlying geometry and expression of good design and how it communicates and also manipulates and lets us connect, you know, not necessarily through words, but through a visual communication, you know, either an expression of a face, but even before that, in the way you're setting up planes, foreground, middle ground, background, or movement of implication of you know, lines and scale and just anything and everything to do with design. That's one thing I'm glad I'm back to teaching basic design. So I love that. More specifically, what are you asking?
Yeah, more specifically, how did you end up as a professor at the Art Institute?
You need money and it's
just feast or
famine all the time. There was a certain point, it was still in Savannah, and my freelance was going wonderful. Big companies, in fact, I right out of my master's school, I did some work for LucasArts. And of course, one of the first or second times where I was like, I've made it, I've broken through, you kind of rise up and you sink down. This is it. As an entrepreneur, you know that.
The roller coaster.
A new level, exactly. But because of that, and I made profits while also teaching, and, you know, also I usually had one or two jobs teaching part-time, and then I was also working in the fitness center.
Okay. Yeah.
And I went to get a mortgage.
Yeah.
And even though I was showing that I was making a profit, they literally, two people definitely looked at me. Other people ignored me, but they said, it doesn't matter how much they're never, and quite right, I came to see, going to, at least at that point when they had some, they didn't have the predatorial mortgages. That they just hand out like candy and they're doing again. Okay. We didn't learn our lessons in 2008 because of that. But I didn't get the mortgage and they said they're never going to get it. You could be making, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, which they're a little bit of an exaggeration, but they're saying, because next year you might not. Next year you've got to be working for a company, make your own company. So the quick fix was, well, I not only got my master's to finish out a portfolio, hide myself away for another year and a half. And I did it fairly quickly. It was a 2 year plus degree. I got done in about a year and a half, but I also thought, like, pragmatically, well, I can also teach while I'm building myself up. So this is the time I realized, all right, time to look for a job. So I looked for a job, and in a matter of weeks, I got a bite from MSU, Mississippi State University. And literally like in 2 weeks, we kind of packed up, or actually I packed up because it took a while for my wife, Susan, to come after me, and went to Mississippi and ended up doing it again for sort of as a fallback, but it took prominence now. And I was also getting better and better jobs. I think I was working at Aliens versus Predator, some licensed stuff, some cool stuff. Again, I made it. and starting to break through with the name of Beginning. And some comic book stuff, and also doing some wonderful stuff, my own stuff with some lower end, but some less known book companies, comic book companies, some, you know, good historical stuff and good literature sort of based comic books, Arthurian lore, stuff that I just loved from reading before, and ended up in teaching, and kind of never looked back from that. You know, both, I think, as a blessing and also a bit of a curse, you know. I always do, you know, depending on the year, I do more or less particular freelance jobs.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So what year did you start at the Art Institute then?
Gosh, I was hired on December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day on 1999.
Okay.
And there too, things, the school had switched, pulled the rug out from underneath me, Mississippi State.
Yeah.
Suddenly decided to make my full-time job, which had just taken me across the country, at least a couple of states, they suddenly decided to make my contract not into full-time, but a full-time adjunct. The schools okay. like to do that. It was the beginning of schools doing that. So I had, I think, even an extra class, but at the same time, I had to take more money to get my medical and all that sort of stuff. Mm. Remember, this was supposed to be my anchor, my easy thing yeah. that keeps going and takes away from risk. So they switched things around, turned a full-time job into a part-time, which they still just wanted to pay me less for full-time work there. And literally, this time Susan got a job out of the blue from some friends in Atlanta. And literally, we turned around in 2 weeks and I left. And literally, it was a week before the semester was going to begin. I was slotted for like four classes, and really good chairman there who was the poor unfortunate manager had to tell me that the school, even though they just paid $75 million for new football stadium seats, was going to wrongly break my contract and turn me into a full-time / part-time paid worker. I had to turn around and go, I'm sorry, you're going to find somebody else. And he's like, ugh, well, yeah. This is what happens when you play around with people like this. So we came to Atlanta. And so when I first got here, I was just doing freelance for a few months. And then I applied to the Art Institute along with a number of different things. And they pretty much hired me immediately.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, so we intersect 2005. I asked you lots of questions. We have lots of great conversations. Anything you remember?
After class, you'd hang out and yeah, I had a good time. I always wondered, you know, what you saw in me. I don't know. Like I said, mate, I was pretty
boisterous. I asked you questions. I think you gave me time. I don't know. It just probably happened organically. We had classes together. But definitely looked up to you. I think for me, you know, moving to Atlanta in 2005, getting married, I had no clue what I was doing. Trying to be entrepreneurial, start a business, go to school. Me essentially trying to find someone that's like, hey, here's some advice on how to navigate the craziness of life.
Oh, yeah. And I'd definitely gone through a number of bumps and was into sort of a mature, like, all right, this is just a business. You're just going to be moving, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I think maybe one of the attributes, my impression, if I remember right, is you seem to care about the students. Like the relationship really mattered, it seemed like. Unless that was the impression I got. It wasn't just about like, yeah. Teach me something, get me out and go to the next class. The relationship mattered, I guess, to you.
Oh, yeah, I loved it. I love talking to people. I love to. People like you or other people are trying to break through to people to really, really help them and give them what they paid for. I was a new teacher too. So new teachers overdo it with, as I've seen, individual time. At least I did, because I was worried that I didn't have enough experience. So I just want to be a little closer to catch things that were going on. And I care about people. So thank goodness that came across. I still do that, you know, it's a little tougher. There's more zombie eyes these days. Maybe not. I don't know. Maybe it's just, you know, older and seen so much.
Probably as a result of our conversations, at some point, I tell you, hey, I'm going to Paris Island. Yeah. Do you want to join me? Something, What, and you said yes. Why did you say yes? And tell me what that trip was for you.
All right. So you had already been, and you as a student, you had already been working as a businessman. And you had some other mentors too. You know, you obviously showed that you saw value in people and wanted to probably, you know, kind of live through them, but listen to them and understand. And take advantage of what they've gone through rather than you having to go through and repeat the same.
Yes.
The same.
Learned other people's hard lessons.
Exactly. So you were really open. It was obvious. It was just, you know, that you were really attuned to it. And, you know, I think we developed a bit of a friendship there too. And yeah, you said you were doing that and it was weird. And I was like, heck yeah. And it was, that was actually the beginning of that summer we talked about where I was starting to have a little bit of a downfall, you know, physically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I was like, and I was trying to make myself do a ton of new things and that just came out of the blue. In fact, it was really, fortunate because I was looking to, and I was attuned to trying to do different things. I was even thinking about getting out of school. So I just said, heck yeah, it was fun. So we went up there for a week, right?
Yeah, something like that. They flew us from Atlanta to Savannah. They actually flew us there and picked us up in a van.
Well, it was great. And it was weird that they did that. So, and they picked us up, and it was a recruiting thing that they were bringing in both. Was it both media and education? Or
yeah, I think teachers and media people. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So they did this once or twice a year. And because I remember talking to the guy, the recruiter who was sort of ferrying us around. And no, that was awesome. We got to see the different different epics or whatever you want to call them, the different stages of their training. And they explained, you know.
And I got some pictures of you climbing their obstacle courses.
Oh yeah, there too. Yeah, I remember we went to the O course, the obstacle course, and every time they raised they got sick of me. Every time they'd be like, "Who wants to do this? Swing across the
moat." Tom does.
I was like, "Oh, this guy again." Yeah,
yeah. You were just, like you were in that season where it's like, "I'm going to do it. Well, I'm not going to say no."
No, I still do it. I almost killed myself sliding down a pole. Like a railing at a soccer stadium like 2 days ago.
Yeah, you're not as young as you used to be.
Kids. No, but you know what I remember during that O course too? Remember they showed us, they actually took us through training of like hand-to-hand training. They got up on a big platform and they were doing different moves and everything. And we got to watch the actual Marines, or not yet Marines, but recruits out there. And then we went out there and did some of the same things. And then they took us through the bayonet training with the guns and the those sort of things. Remember what I volunteered for next?
Was it the so I remember we did the M16 shooting, which I did.
Oh, that was good. That was awesome.
And if I remember right, did they also demonstrate a rocket? I can't remember.
Oh, they did. They did. There was an A4 anti-tank rocket. No. But the physical training, they then put us in the circle with the pugil sticks. Remember they have those hurt. Remember I went in
this lean trainer? On the round thing or something?
Yeah. The pugil sticks have the long, they look like big, whatever they've got padding on either. So I went against the guy and one of the trainers fighting, and actually, I parried one blow, and they're all young kids too. They're, even though they're sergeants and drill sergeants, they're all young kids. And the other boys are like, "Oh, look at them!" You know. And this guy got mad, and I remember because right at the last moment he was playing back and forth. And I hit him in the chest, and then he went to hit me over top, and I parried it. And I still feel it in my hand, like a visceral memory. Like, oh my gosh,
I did it.
And at that point too, I swung around and hit him between the legs, and at that point, he nearly knocked me out. Took my helmet off. And they were all laughing, and they were like, "Well, this guy wants to play."
I probably have the footage of that somewhere. I just need to find the tape.
I would love to see. Please, my girls would love to see that. My girls, because we didn't have phones back then like we do now too.
Yeah.
But no, you're talking about the we went out by the swamps to Paris Island to shoot, and we got like 10 rounds.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that. And then there was an anti-tank there too. But I remember when we were in there and they're explaining the different. Different weapons.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're up there with a weapon. It's a H&K M248. So it was it fires 5.56. And the guy was up there and he's trying to explain. Somebody asked him about the handle that was on the barrel. And yeah. He said, oh, you can swap it out. And they're showing us all. And the guy was like, I can't get it off. And I raised my hand and I said, you got to lock the bolt back first before you can remove the barrel. And they look at me like, what the hell? And it's like, he's right. And he locked it back and they pulled it out.
That's it was funny. Fun. I remember the last thing was, I believe we witnessed or watched a graduation of one of the classes. And they had the ceremony and all that. And I found that to be pretty profound, just the values that they have and that they instill and that they celebrate as part of the. Mm-hmm.
I remember, I just remember the joy. I remember the seriousness. They were taking an oath that was very serious. It was solemn. It was so, you could just, your chest would explode with pride seeing these guys. The thing I remember the most about that is the girls that came out. It was scary. Not that they weren't women and feminine and everything, but they were warriors at that point.
Yeah.
And the way they barked out, you know, the returns to the commands and so on. It was kind of alien, but I was really proud for that too. It was very, very noteworthy.
Yeah. So something about that experience stirred something inside of you that made you want to take that to the next step. What was going on there?
Well, here, so I was experiencing a somewhat of a malaise,
like a midlife crisis, would you say?
I wouldn't say way pre midlife. I guess that's relative to when I die. I guess it was. If I die soon, it was a midlife. So I was doing different things, which was the reason why I was up there. So I actually had made sort of a bucket list sort of thing way before that term was even around there. I just wanted to do different things, learn languages, and just not sit back and just be swept along in a current. And I realized what was going on with me. So went through that summer, and more of those things were happening to me. And at that time, the war was going on. I hadn't served before, friends had served and everything. So I started looking into and actually got involved in being set up to get a waiver to go, because I was older. I was 36 at the time, get a waiver to go into to the Army. Literally, I was stuck in a, and because of that too, I was, after that kind of affected me, I spoke to some of the Marines that had gone through a number of different things. And obviously, you know, from what I just said, I understood about weapons and history and reading and so on. And so I talked to them a lot about some of the battles that had gone on, because ever since that war began, I made sure that I got the daily
update,
deaths, casualty names and everything. I made a habit of, no matter how many names were on that list, the television didn't do it anymore. Although there was a little bit of a rebirth of patriotism during the war, beginning of the wars, that is, before they wore down. But I made a habit of reading out their names and saying a prayer to make sure I said this boy, or this, most of the boys, but this girl's name out loud. Gave him a little prayer every day, or at least I'd catch up. I signed up at the DOD for it. My mind was already there. My heart, my upbringing. American. I was going to say traditional. I'm an American. There shouldn't be any difference. And I got in a traffic jam outside a recruiting station. I was moving along slowly and slowly and slowly, and I was just staring at this recruiting thing. And finally, when I got up to, just being sick of moving inches, got up to the entrance of recruitment, I pulled on in and went and had my first conversation about the possibility of joining, you know. And my wife, it's incredibly, I don't know, she's nuts, but she's incredibly supportive.
Wow.
Maybe hoping that I would just kind of like talk and see it through and whatever. And I was just considering National Guard, but that would have been, you know, multiple camps and so on. And I could have still worked and then also served. And because of my degrees, I would have gone in as an officer. I was a little old, so I had to get a waiver for.
And you did get it?
Yeah. I went through that. Yeah. I went through all of the different different testing and got right up to the weekend where I was doing some physical testing and everything. In fact, I was in pretty good shape at 36. I was got out there and I was scoring everything but the 3 mile run. I scored at the top percent for an 18-year-old. So
So you were healthy. But
I was healthy. I've been running all along because I felt something was missing. I was losing weight. I stopped drinking beer. And I just felt I had to do something more. That something was wrong in my life, and I was going to fix it and even go and serve and just do something bigger than me and serve my country.
In retrospect, what do you see? Because you said you felt like something was missing in your life. What do you see that as now? How do you see that now?
Honestly, I think I was slowly dying of cancer. I didn't realize I was dying of cancer. So I had leukemia, the onset of it. And it was weird how I found it out. I mentioned it to you before. I went in just for simple glasses, and it was the oddest thing in the world. That morning, one of the kids was sniffling. I had two little girls, a 1.5-year-old and an 11-month-old, or thereabouts, 2-year-old and 11-month-old.
Yeah.
And they're sniffling, and my wife was like, oh, let's just skip this. And I said, no, I need new glasses. I said, we've got kids. They've got to deal with life. We've got to deal with life with our kids. We're going to go over there. Thank goodness. I went over there, and while my wife is, and it was just a Target's optometrist or whatever you'd call it, but it was a real doctor there. And he looked at my eyes and looked over stuff. And then he put away he made a big deal of putting away, because he was going to ask me something, his documentation. He said, off the record, but do you use cocaine or meth at all? I was like, no, I'm really healthy. Run every time in the morning. I was getting my 4 and 5 in the morning. That was whole part of like, get your butt going. There's something wrong. You're like coasting here. He said, well, there's something wrong. You're bleeding in your eyes. And, he asked if I had headaches and all this sort of stuff. And he said, I want you to go to this one, this special eye surgeon. So the eye surgeon, I went there. And I don't know whether he immediately gave me laser surgery. I think he did to stop the bleeding in the eyes, because you got to stop the bleeding first before you take care of whatever's causing it.
Yeah.
And then he said, I want you to, they thought immediately it was, some sort of, what's the thing that you need? Insulin. How am I missing? Diabetes.
Yeah, I can.
So they thought, because that can attack eyes like that. So they did that, those things, and that came up zero. And it happened really quick. So then I went to a cardiologist, and they thought it was some heart condition, because this was also. And he immediately, he said, your EKG is fine and everything, but I'm going to send you some more tests. We're going to figure this out. And he had this kind of knowing. I mean, maybe I'm projecting now, but I do remember looking down the hall, and he had this really dour face talking to this nurse saying, call up this guy, do this, must get him over. He said, we've set you up with, just like the optometrist who was like, go to this guy. This heart doctor just for me without even asking. He's like, get over here, right now, go over there right now to this clinic and get these blood tests. So I went over and did that. I did that. All right. And a day and a half later, I was taking, one of my girls to a strep test and about to go. I was literally zipping up her jacket. We're going to go out the door to take care of her. And I got the call from the doctor, and the doctor was like, is anybody there with you? You don't know me. I'm your doctor's partner. He goes, this has been on the desks, was here waiting for us. I opened it up because it was urgent. And he asked me, he goes, you're a very sick man. Can you stand up? Do you need a ride? Can I call you a cab? You've got to get to a doctor. You've got to get some medicine right now. Do you have headaches? You're passing out? And I'm like, no, I just ran 7 miles, which is, that's what kept me from having a big physical fall down. I would literally force of mind. I was also doing, I was big time into Tony Robbins.
Okay, yeah.
I was charting everything. I was, finally going to, it was all reaction somehow to my body, my mind, my emotions, everything, something was wrong. And I figured that I just, like what man tries to do with himself, right?
Yeah.
He doesn't turn to somebody else. It's like, you run and you chart more goals and you do more stuff for yourself. You'll take care of those real big things in life, and and you'll get it back on track. But I force you will. But no, it was leukemia, I guess, and it was affecting me completely, mind, body, soul. Mm-hmm. And again, my body was saying something's wrong, something's wrong, something's wrong. And I just interpreted it as like, oh, you need to do more. You need more success, more this, more that, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I got there, and they did their spinal taps. It was so weird with that. The doctor sent me to go get medicine, and the oncologist, who's still my oncologist, had me do a spinal tap because we need one.
Yeah.
They needed a core for the fusion tests because they needed to.
Because leukemia is based in the bones, right?
Leukemia is a broad name for all sorts of blood cancers. Lymphoma is the same thing as lymphoma. Lymphoma. It could be a lot of, there's like at least 22 different types.
Okay.
That have nothing to do other than it's an attack. And they generally also make the body, it's an immune system, make the body destroy itself. Now, what's going on? On the brain and bleeding my eyes. And
yeah.
I was trying to jog it away.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
So I got there and they pulled a .22 caliber size core out of my spine and sent it off. Yeah. And so I had to wait around for a month to see exactly what type of leukemia I had.
In that limbo, are you terrified? Are you in denial? Are you just fine? What do you think?
Well,
what's your headspace?
I decided I was going to keep on working. I wasn't going to stay home dark and alone while my wife went off to work and my kids went off to daycare. And I just had eat bonbons with all this in my head. So I kept on working. I didn't tell anybody, but I was waiting, and it took about 3 weeks or so on for her to come back. But immediately after that first visit, they gave me the paperwork, and it's this alien stuff, very scientific looking stuff. Giving you these general things. And what I remember is like, you've got anywhere from 0 to 4 years to live, and that's it. And of course, anybody's gone through this, there's much more. And maybe that's true. I'm not saying that those stats went wrong, but it's not as easy just to read that. So if you're ever in a position, if anybody's ever in a position where they're reading that, look into it more. It's probably a lot better.
Yeah.
Depending on your case.
Yeah.
Because of statistics. I mean, an average is right in the middle. So there's lots more on the top side. Unfortunately, there's a lot more on the bottom side of any diagnosis.
And what year was this?
This was right after we got back from Paris Island.
Okay, so it was that same year. Okay.
Yeah, like I said, Paris Island was part of my whole
let's
do fun and weird things and change things. So that's why I jumped on it.
Mm.
And it was weird too. Actually, bring up Paris Island and the recent all of the legal cases dealing with the water part, Paris Island, because I got contacted about that too. anyways, so yeah, no, so I had to come to grips with it. I remember that afternoon just reading that stuff and looking in the mirror and just telling myself, no matter what happened, that I was going to try to be there, you know, mind and totally for my children. That the thing is, for some reason, I just did not want to be drugged. All right, I did not want to have 4 minutes or 4 days or 4 months of being drugged and not recognizing my babies, not seeing them. All right, I didn't want to be a different person. So I was just praying to God, like, that I could endure whatever pain came, that I would not turn away, that just take whatever happened, because I wanted to be aware. All right, I would not, I can't trade away not having the pain, but also not having the love and the contact with my children. We had another story with having babies too, years and years. That was my thought. It wasn't like, give me more time, give me more time. I never went through the different steps. I just accepted it. And also day to day, you know, but I don't remember asking for any more time or denying it or whatever. From that moment, I'm like, oh, okay. And my wife was really amazing too. She was like, oh, okay. I'll come pick up the kids. You go to the doctor. I remember that. And that was tough. But luckily what happened is after those 3 weeks, they realized that a certain type of leukemia, CML, chronic myelogenous leukemia, and it can be controlled by a certain drug or a broad band of drugs. It's really kind of a wonder drug that helps in a ton of different things. Helps amazing a number of different things, and it just started to be being used. And I qualified for that, and it blocks a certain chromosome that had developed in me. It's called the Philadelphia chromosome, and its basic signal is turn on white blood cells. Which, okay. When they don't find an infection to fight, they start fighting your body. All right.
Yeah.
So I always, luckily I had that. And that usually comes from like, nuclear poisoning or whatever.
Radiation.
Radiation poisoning.
Yeah.
Right? And basically I also got a second opinion, which you should, especially when you've got cancer and you're dying. One, you should know what's killing you right down to the molecular level. Too many people just go, okay.
Yeah.
And because the doctor, you know, you've got to go and find your own proper care. You don't want to give your life to, no matter how nice the doctors are, they're just a doctor. And two, get a second opinion. So another guy, a doctor told me, basically we're bombarded with all sorts of cosmic rays and things shooting through us. And normally, whether it's a physical scratch, you know, chromosomes are physical. So the genes get broken, and they should just die and get put in the lymph system, get pumped into your circulatory system, get filtered out and excreted. But this, for some reason, bands number 9 and number 22 decided to curl over and immediately heal up together. And they made a brand new kind of twisted band. And of course, chromosomes replicate. It's a new plan. And this plan said, you know, start attacking your body. So I had the Philadelphia chromosome. And I don't really know. I shouldn't. Depending on who you, what you read about it, it's either was discovered in Philadelphia, or it was an outcome of the Philadelphia experiment, where tons of people in Oppenheimer's group died of the same radiation poisoning
during the Manhattan Project.
Yeah, the Manhattan. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the Philadelphia chromosome. Yeah.
So how did that experience transform you or change you?
I beat myself up because I'm kind of a driven person and want to depend on myself. Like I said, I was going to jog my way out of whatever happened or do things because I'm in control. Certainly, it's a big wake up that you're not in control. Now, did it completely drive me towards, you know, God or whatever? I was already a Christian, right? But I was very double-minded. I didn't really wake up to really what I think is really believing in God and really seeking after him until later. And that's what age tends to do. So I can't really attribute that to, I mean, it's all part of it, but I can't really attribute it to that. What it did with me, straight back to the first thing I thought of with my children and wanting to be with them. That's it. It just refocused me on more important things. I like I said, I was driven. So I kind of beat myself up like, oh, you lost your motivation. But I just wanted to be with my kids. I just wanted to be with my daughter, my daughters.
Soon after this, you have twins, right?
Yeah. And so they came like 8 years later, No, maybe not that. When was it? 2000.
So this was 2007, I think.
2009.
Okay. So a year or two later.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, but I was, and it kind of deflated me, but in a good way. I stopped one egotism or also wanting to be something, wanting to have that name. I still wanted to do things. I still loved it and everything, but I didn't care. I kind of beat myself up like, well, you haven't done your best-selling book. Well, you haven't done this yet. You haven't done that yet. And I'm like, I realized that was all egotism. And that wasn't
Where did those voices come from?
From my upbringing, by beating myself up for not wanting anymore to get out there and really make a name for myself. I still did it. I'm not saying, but just that, or you should look at this second chance in life and really start staying up and getting those books out. No, I had what I needed. It was my children and my life and the other gifts God had given me, just being alive. Mm. And again, I also beat myself up. I didn't just recognize that. I thought something had happened to me, like I was lazy. I didn't give myself some time, too. Like, you've gone through something here. And by the way, I still thought I could die. It's not till just recently that they've quote-unquote, deemed me to be in therapeutic remission, which means this drug that was originally supposed to stop me from dying now actually somehow, even though they don't really have the real reason why, just through obvious now is curing people. So I volunteered to go off it now. So after about 13, 14 years on it, I'm off it now for a couple of years now, and they're still watching me, but I haven't taken the drug since.
Yeah.
But anyways, back to that point, it just kind of deflated me. And I did a lot of, you know, beating myself up and trying to get back into my old life of just striving for businesses and name and, deflating is it? I just felt deflated, but it's not. I think it righted my center, and I still needed more, but it definitely was the first part of me not worrying so much about me. If anything, you know, I think of Ecclesiastes, right? Yeah. All is vanity, and I never thought it was vain, but my mother told me all the time I was. She was right. But I guess it doesn't. I tell my daughters this too. Something doesn't, just because it can be worse doesn't mean you aren't horrible. I was like, that was vain. I was slightly vain, but I guess, the vanity kind of went away, and that turned into some, you know, flagellation. But so that was the beginning of it. And then I went in the middle of my life with my kids. And I just recently, when I say recently, it seems like 5, 6 years, and it's up and down. In fact, you know, I think a signature of really getting rid of that double-mindedness that I think that Matthew spoke of is realizing this day to day. And that's healthy thing that you're not great. And I'm going to sound like Wreck-It Ralph. You're not great. And that's great. You
know? Yeah.
You're the bad guy, which means you're not, that doesn't mean you're the bad guy. I don't know. but I think that was the beginning of it, but I still just thought there's God as a finishing line.
Yeah.
And just recently, and like I say years, and as you get older, years do just become recently, but do I really understand one, how I'm not in charge? That whole episode showed me that, and how things are provided for you, and that contentment is, there's man-made contentment and laziness and that sort of stuff, but that certain things are given, your state, stage in life, including, you were talking about suffering, even the suffering, and actually that's some of the best things that can
into that more,
the challenges and the suffering that drive you more and more towards God, and realizing your part and that you're a tool in his hands, and you just give it up, you know, that's deflate. I don't know. Deflate of the bad part of me, the man, you know, the creature, and turn to the creator. It wasn't finished, but I think it, as I look back, it that definitely began. It must. I mean, it was a tough time. it's a big deal. But yeah, the better part of me just comes towards just letting go. And that's a daily thing, and that's good. So.
Yeah. Well, where are you? I could keep asking you more questions, but we're a little after two here, so.
I can go a little bit longer. I'm fine.
All right.
I'll just have to go out and trim the bushes in the front of the house after this. Then I've got a soccer game later.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. So you've maybe to kind of clarify a couple of things. You've talked about kind of living before and after and working before and after and that clarifying. So when you think about living better and working smarter, how do you contextualize those things now through the experiences that you've gone through?
Mm-hmm. Oh, can you reword that, please?
Yeah. So what does it mean for you to live better? And what does it mean for you to work smarter?
Oh, living better. You know, I never just gave myself a day off. I'm never consider myself a workaholic. Sorry, I just had my fox horn.
Superman is arriving.
That's what you thought. it's like a fox horn. My kids are all up in D.C. right now.
Living better, smarter, and smarter.
What'd you say?
Yeah, I was just saying, live better, work smarter, just to remind you. Yeah.
Okay. So, I think I can put things in different boxes and not always want to work. And also, the worst thing I used to do, I used to not do work. I used to go on vacation. I used to have a weekend. But I would never just let, especially my own work, my own personal work, because it was personal, just be put on a shelf. Okay, I was always doing something. And the weird thing, when you're always doing something, you're doing multiple things. You're never just doing something. You're always, you can never enjoy, the work is always plagued by other things you have to do. And when you try to enjoy yourself, the enjoyment is always plagued by the professional stuff, much less if it's a deadline you're missing or, to be able to put it away and turn it off and say, nope.
Setting and enforcing boundaries around work.
Bam. That's it. Absolutely. So I can give myself a weekend, even if I feel like I'm in, quote unquote trouble. There's something going on. Well, that'll start on Monday. What is it? Go back to the Bible. There's a wonderful phrase. I wish I'd memorized it because half memorized it. tomorrow is its own trouble.
Don't worry about tomorrow.
Ecclesiastes, but I think Jesus said that. Just let it go. And the story of Martha, and being at the feet of, as opposed to sitting at the feet of Jesus, just understanding where you should be in your life. Okay. And being in the presence. In fact, we were talking about the Screwtape letters earlier. There's a part when Screwtape talks about the oppression of time, and more so the oppression of focusing always on the future, always getting there, never being. Don't let them just be there, because being there is sort of like stepping out of time, where God is outside of the arc of time. And he said, make them always more, always something else, always something, some worry or something wonderful in the future, never being satisfied and so on. To the point where he talked about one of his projects. They actually called them their food, or demons' food. He said, I got him to I delivered him to the gates of our father's house, Satan's house. And he said, and I stood there as he looked at me and he goes, I don't think in all my life I ever did what I was supposed to do, much less did something that I wanted to. I was always just, and that's important. I was just swept up in something going and something going and something going. And it's good stuff, but it's just stuff. Idols and idols upon idols.
Yeah.
As we are, the forever machines, eternally making idols.
So what is it for you to set and enforce that boundary and to let it go? Like, for me, it was a trust thing, like trusting that God would provide despite my limitations.
Absolutely.
Do you see it the same way or differently?
Absolutely. Look, I knew that, right? So we know things and we say things and we believe things, but do we really...
That's the double-mindedness.
Do we really live it? Do we really live it? And to live it is to seriously give it to the Lord, and I can die tomorrow. I'm not going to say, like, I'd be happy. No, there's plenty of reasons my family being left behind. It would not be. Or even worse, somebody else could die that you love. And do I believe this thing or not?
Yeah.
If I believe it, yes, I am wrapped up in the mortal coil. All right. A little Shakespeare for you. Which makes you think, and of course it's a veil or a boundary between you and you know, the true world.
Yeah.
So of course you're going to feel those feelings, but to give it up and say, I do believe, I do trust, nothing's in control, the Lord is sovereign, regardless, you already know and can see, I'm not in control, and just letting that go. Especially during this, I could use different words, but I'll use a common word, pandemic. I think a lot of our society and the world realized they didn't have anything, so, right? When their job, whether they love it or not, is the thing that they do every day. It's them. Whether they like it or not, or to yell at me for saying it is not, you know, give me some of their worldly philosophy back. Realize there's nothing in the core, or there are things that they don't want to admit. Namely, the idol of the government, which tried to fill that vacuum. And me and my family, I don't think we went through that much. At least I tried not to. Certainly I used it as a lesson to make sure we built up and inoculated them more. But they don't have the little 4-inch glowing box, you know. I mean, everybody does, but they leave it exactly where my old-fashioned phone would be, up there on the counter by the sink, you know, where the phone used to be that was put into the wall. They leave it there. They have family. They have a belief in America, Western civilization. All right, the good things, with an understanding. Believe me, I'm not a cynic, but I am certainly a would-be student of history. All right, I don't want to be a fool, and so I've tried to fill them up, and I have too. And right from the first moment, a few months into it, I turned around and I remember in our minivan with the kids in the back, and I told them where things were going to go. I said, where the inclinations of man and inclinations of government, all governments, I'm not ganging up on governments. Governments have to, they're a government. But where it was going to go, and I hoped not, and I sounded like a nut. And I think my oldest laughed a little. My mom and her mother, my wife was like, no, Dad is telling me right, you know, just historically. And they saw it happen. But the biggest thing that happened that I've tried to make them realize, and I'll make it into a lesson for my kids now, that I think that I realize is that there's so much emptiness, all right, that there's or just this gulf that's filled up with this constant, I don't know, there's certainly not edifying philosophies that are out there. Regardless secular or sacred, there's this eek of this, you mentioned postmodernism and secularism and nihilism. I mean, all of these things, Marxist and so on, just another ism. It's just a will of man, and which the will of man for power is always going to devour and divide people. And we suddenly see it, but all the people don't really get it. They don't understand that their world is actually being ruled by men that they wouldn't necessarily have to look at them, wouldn't even consider them men. I mean, at least by my standards. But these other thinkers that have had, from Rousseau to Descartes, to, I mean, bad and good ways, that battled over what the state of man should be. Is there a God? Isn't there a God? The evolution of man, man's nature. And we are being ruled. Some of the chickens are coming home to roost with those philosophies in our postmodern world. I hate that, you know, but that's the name. And we're seeing that all those eggheads, manifestos, all those things have little by little shown fruit in society. And, you know, and even though people could not mention it, they're living in that current right now. And we're all, it just was slow and slow and academic, and all of a sudden, at least tried to be thrusted all of a sudden at us. And we can see this through other globalist forces and so on.
Well, so I think what I'm hearing from you too is also like, it's really important. Yeah. Important for you to particularly with your kids, you've said it a lot, teaching mm-hmm. them. And so mm-hmm. you talk in that sense, it's you're mentoring your kids, right? You're parenting them, but you're mentoring them. So yeah. How do you see it, and how does it play a role? Because that's one of the ways, I suppose, that you're attempting to combat a lot of the problems that you see in society. Well, one is, hey, I can at least mentor my kids in the right direction. So how do you make sense of that phenomenon?
Well, you try to be there for people around you, real people, you know, the only people, especially with the technology. You know, I don't have any friends on this. If I do, they're also friends. I can go shake their hand or fly to Texas and shake their hand that way. They're real people I met in a real way and can still talk to real, because we've got that. All right. No texts and abbreviations and cute little sibboleths and so on along the way. So it's real contact and showing them real care, and how, by giving part of my life to them, by being there with them, demonstrating. All right. I can blather on, so, you know, I can do that. But demonstrating by being up in the morning and being, even though I'm tired, good morning, you know, and making sure I have an inflection in my voice. They see Dad at night. Maybe I'm working and I stop work, which is tough. A little kid comes there, like, ask your mom, you know, you want to send him anyway. But just stop. And you maybe turn things off, because sometimes, you know, you've got to just remove things from, you know, into another room. And just be there in the littlest consistent ways, you know. And I'm talking about quality and quantity. I have been, I might have my regrets about, not really, as I was saying, about, you know, the best-selling book. Well, yeah, it's a second draft right now after 3 years, eventually or not.
Yeah.
But my life has allowed me to be with my children a lot, and to be.
Well, and you mentioned
more than my work and some. So go on.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you mentioned, you know, modeling for them and also teaching them, and so. What's the difference between being and modeling versus just giving someone advice? Which one do you think is more important?
Committing to help them out and meaning it. You know, sometimes you go, oh, they took me up my word, so I guess I'm meeting them, you know.
But so
you
following operate. Through, yeah.
And you follow through. You say something, which also be careful what you say, because you should follow through on it, especially a younger person who's doing that, especially these days. Somebody's going to reach out and actually follow through. Just being there for them all the time, remembering their name, really listening to them, which is in and of itself a skill, which I have day to day, you know, or not.
Now you've mentioned a lot about stories, like you mentioned the Screwtape Letters. What are some other real or fictional stories that you haven't already talked about that have shaped you as a person?
Oh my goodness. You know, ever since I was a little kid, it's my superheroes or whatever. I like heroes. But most of all, I like heroes that sacrifice. That even if they know that the outcome, physical outcome, all right, is a losing battle, that they continue. You know, a Norse hero, you know, the jump into the fiery mouth of gosh, I wish I could remember some Norse monsters. They're always hard to pronounce. But just would jump in there with a big battle axe. All right. Yeah, that's
yeah. Cool.
But other ones, Bonhoeffer, it's just,
yeah.
I won't, you know, in their mind, I won't. You can do this to me. I won't. You know, I will not. Thomas More, that stand by. The larger, and as you get older, the real, the most heinous monsters of men and control, manipulation, and man's inhumanity of man. Those people who just refuse to, even if they're quiet, nobody even knows them. Gosh, who is the character that stories of redemption, stories of sacrifice, and the heroicness of sacrifice, or a quiet death that nobody knows.
Yeah.
But it was the hinge pin of history that might not be recognized ever, if not definitely while they're alive. Who's that character in The Tale of Two Cities?
I can't remember his name.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, I should remember his name but absolutely, that went to death for another man. Right? It was beautiful, but also sacrificed, found meaning in that, and comforting other people and going to the death of the guillotine at the end of that.
What
is the famous phrase? What is it? I mean that. What is it? 'Tis a far, far better place that I go that I've ever been, to the far, far better thing that I do that I ever have done. The guy was a ne'er-do-well all his life, a drunk, and he fell in love with a woman that truly loved, in an unselfish, actually he realized selfish way, but his love turned into an unselfish way, fell in love with her, and then hated the man she actually ended up marrying and loving. But then when he was, and if people are interested, they should go read the book. It's Charles Dickens. Went and there was, right from the beginning of the book, he had been mistaken for that same guy. So he used that and he went to France. It was the two cities was London and Paris. He went to France to switch himself out in the Bastille. I think it was the Bastille, the prison there. And suffer the other man's death and give this lady who he loved her husband back to him and took his death from him. It's those sort of stories. And so it's more of a type.
Yeah.
Right. Heck, I love a good adventure, a kicking in the door sort of thing like that. Those things are, that type of story.
Yeah. Right?
No matter what the wrap of the narrative and the sequence of actions and events go around it, that sort of thing, that there's something bigger. And that it's always about helping others.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that. It's brilliant. And of course, that's wrapped up in, you know, the myth become real. As C.S. Lewis would say, Christ story and his passion.
Yeah.
I love those stories. And it always comes back to that. In fact, you said you hadn't read Surprised by Joy.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
I have not.
He'll talk about his love of stories, his idea that that all pagan history and myths and so on are always an echo of the promise and there and then the events of Christ before and after, and they always play out. There's always a echo of the steps that they left from to go down to earth, that the footstep of God before they step off the cloud, as it were, that shows up. That's why it's across all sorts of cultures and all sorts of different religions and so on. You get Promethea, right? Delivering the fire from the gods to, and therefore being, you know, sacrificed every day upon the rock.
Yeah.
Those sort of things. I love that. And any story that has anything like that. And really, if you look at Joseph Campbell's Heroes with Thousand Faces, it's a hero with a thousand faces. It all comes back to something like that, something bigger and better than us that can get us out of and tell us we're something more than just our little, our appetites, that thing that is, there's us before. I'm hungry. I'm thirsty. I'm sleepy. Sexual appetites, whatever. There's something there. If we strip there, is there something there?
Yeah. You know,
after all that. Maybe that goes back to the thing we found out with the pandemic, that there wasn't anything, or that there was a need to fill it in with something a little more eternal than just materialistic or appetite-based things. So when you have a hero that addresses those things, that's the best sort of story that drives us towards a better self. That's what art should do, and that's what obviously narrative art should do. So bantering.
Well, tell us what parting words of wisdom would you want to share with us? Anything you wanted to say that you didn't get a chance to yet?
I don't know. I guess just piggybacking what I just said there, it all comes down to, you know, turn yourself to, you know, Lord Jesus Christ. Just give it up and stop fighting.
Yeah.
He's there for you. He's never turned away. He's closer than anybody could ever be there to you. He's waiting. He'll walk after you. He's looking for you. He's steadfast. Never errs, never betrays. And whatever vision you have of him, he's there for you. And after that, life becomes what it should, regardless of what suffering, whatever lessons you go through, because that's what suffering is, it's lessons. I mean, it's all over at that point. You find your place. You can enjoy the life, the goodness of life. You can also not worry so much about the badness of life and give it to him and just realize he's always been there and he is there. And just it's over. Just give it up and turn to Christ. So
I'd say that. Well, thank you for sharing. If people want to connect with you, what's the best way for them to do that? You have are you on social media? You have a website, LinkedIn?
I might. I just let my website domain go. I probably can get it again. It'll be my full name, Thomas or TomBeyondDeLillo.com. Recently, I had to buy it from a dentist in Illinois. I bought it just to give it up 3 years later. No, I don't have any. Much of that, and I do need to, as soon as I get something else going, I do believe in social media for particular reasons, marketing or connection, but no, I don't have any.
So LinkedIn would probably be the best place.
LinkedIn, in my old LinkedIn profile that I haven't updated in a while, but I do. That is the only one I do check, and I get all sorts of notifications from, so my LinkedIn.
Okay, sounds good. And then anything else?
No, that's it. I want to get together with you and find out more about your podcasting, and I've always been interested in that and that sort of stuff. Just catch up with more in what you're doing. I've got to go back and look at more of your podcasts and listen to other things.
I'll send you a link to some of the stuff. There's a couple ones that relate to some of what we talked about, but so thanks so much for sharing.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been flattering, and you've fed the one aspect of my personality that I'm most proud of, which is my great humility. So, so I appreciate it. But we haven't talked for a while, so let's get together. I want to meet your kids. I never met your kids. All right. God bless you, man. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Share Life. For additional stories and systems to live better and work smarter, visit jasonscottmontoya.com. That's jasonscottmontoya.com. We look forward to having you listen in on the next episode of Share Life.
Are you a freelancer struggling to get clients and sustain an income? Check out Jason Montoya's book, Path of the Freelancer, where he provides the blueprint for mastering freelancing and sustaining a business of one. Start generating a six-figure freelancing income. Get Path of the Freelancer, an actionable guide to flourishing in freelancing on Amazon today.